Good evening, everybody. This is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale, Arizona. And thanks for joining us for another of our virtual events. And tonight, we're really happy to have Richard Chizmar going to be discussing the new book, Becoming the Boogeyman. And Richard signed a batch of books for us. And we still have kind of a dwindling supply. But I will put a link in the comments field if you'd like to go ahead and order one. And then also joining us is Michael Corita, a good friend, and this is his most recent book, An Honest Man, and we have long been sold out of signed copies, but we do have copies. So I'll put a link in the comments field as well for that. If you have questions for Richard or Michael, go ahead and put them in, and Barbara will bring me on screen towards the end of the hour, and I would be happy to ask any questions. So Barbara, over to you.
Thank you very much, Patrick. For the fashion conscious, I would like to point out that I dressed to match this book. Right? Hardly ever happens.
Love it.
It's actually kind of a theme this week, this particular color scheme, which I suppose maybe it's a autumnal thing or, you know, I don't know, whatever it
I
is.
I have a red pen at least.
Yay, Michael. And actually, Michael, your summer book that we love so much was kind of designed summer. So I guess we can assume that publishers actually pay some attention to the season. So I would also like to point out that this is a novel. When you read it, you will be convinced it's real. There are excellent photographs, which Rich can tell us how. I love, there's a great author note, but don't read it till you finish the book. But Rich will then reveal where some of the photos came from and other useful things. But Michael, talk to me, maybe you can describe it better than I. What is metafiction? It's a term that comes up. I've actually published two books in my time, The Woman in the Library and another one by Sue Larry Gentle, which we describe as metafiction. But what does that mean to you?
I mean, to me, it's when the writer is on the page within the fiction, inhabiting the story in a way where the autobiographical is very much there. And you don't know as the audience member where exactly the line is. You know, what is something they're revealing that is true about themselves, and what is something that is just wholly invented? And I think Rich does this incredibly well. And as you mentioned, the photos, the lengths to which he has gone immerse the reader in this sort of universe and world is just, it's fascinating. I can't really think of anyone else who's done the same thing. It's really great.
Right. Well, I think the line between fiction and the real is blurred in metafiction. It doesn't, in Sulari's books, it's actually the lines between the characters. She has two stories going on and you can't tell for sure, you know, which is real, which is whatever. But
Anthony Hurwitz is kind of doing the same thing.
Yeah, that's right. It, absolutely true. So, Rich, why did that appeal to you when you wrote Chasing the Boogeyman, for which this is the sequel, which became a great bestseller? What inspired you to develop this narrative form?
Honestly, I didn't start out to do that with Chasing the Boogeyman. I sat down and I wrote about half of the introduction, and it's a lengthy introduction. It's you know, a good 10 or 12 pages long. And I got 6 or 7 pages into it, and I just realized, you know what, I had already decided it was my hometown. I called it such, you know, Edgewood, Maryland. Everything that was to come, especially in the first third of the book, was going to be pulled out of my memory banks, as far as my family, my fiance. You know, I was a recent college graduate working on a magazine called Cemetery Dance. So all of that was real life. But I was going to have this, you know, different narrator, you know, made up name. And I got 6 or 7 pages in and I just shook my head and I said, this is me. And this is the one book I can't pretend it's not me. And I've always been a true crime fan. So it all kind of in those handful of moments, it just crystallized that I was going to put Richard Chizmar in the book. This is, you know, was going to be my voice. It was going to be kind of my conscience. And I was going to tell a very personal story. And it ended up being, I didn't realize quite how much of a roll of the dice it was until my agent kind of, you know, gave me the side eye and was like, well, let me take a read. And fortunately, a week or two later, she's like, all right, you won me over. You know, you did good, Rich. So, but yeah, that's where it came from. It's just really a case of me following how the story wanted to be told. You know, I look back now and I say it's the only way that Chasing the Boogeyman could have been told and been a decent book, I think. So,
well, I have to say that your timing was brilliant, because as we all know, the True Crime Podcast has really taken off. And I think people have become, these are, by the way, just to give you an idea, these are the photos. I found a few here that keep coming up in the story. But I think that the line between fiction and true crime is blurring too. What do you guys think? I mean, I think with the podcast, people are making heroes where they used to have private eyes. Now we have a true crime podcaster is actually the sleuth.
Yeah, there was the Rebecca Mackay book. I'm blanking on the title, came out earlier this year, where she really leaned into that, and that did very well. It's also kind of fascinating to me as a journalist to watch the, I'm thinking of the murders in Delphi, Indiana. So you're aware of those. I did a journalistic piece about those early on, and to watch the family try to both, you know, utilize that infrastructure of true crime obsession and the fans, and then also have to defend themselves from it at all times, is, it can be both fascinating and morally repulsive at the same time. And I think that's one of the reasons Rich's novels have been so intriguing to me, is you let yourself imagine the scenario of, what would this do to my family? You know, because it's not just about cracking the door open and saying, okay, to the reader, come into my life, let's imagine this crime playing out. It's also, at what cost? And that's, a lot of fiction asks that question, but you're making it more personal. So if you don't mind talking about that a little bit, I'd love to hear.
Yeah, I especially with this book, you know, with Chasing the Boogeyman, it was different family. You know, it was the family I was born into. It was my mother and my father, which was a delight to write about, because they had been gone for over 10 years, you know, each of them. So while I was writing it, they were alive again. And that was, it was fun to sit down at the keyboard every day, write about my friends who were, you know, still, you know, young then. And some of them, unfortunately, aren't around anymore. So that was kind of a neat trip in the time machine. Whereas Becoming the Boogeyman is about, you know, the family that my wife, Kara, and I have raised. And I'll just say right now, Kara's the only person who is in the book, who is in either book, who isn't happy to be in either book. She's very much behind the scenes, and she is tortured knowing that she is in virtually every chapter of Becoming the Boogeyman. She refuses to read it until it comes out in paperback, because she says that way, when anyone engages her in a conversation, she can say, I haven't read it, don't tell me. And she can kind of cut the conversation off. But I did have fun teasing her, like threatening to write love scenes and things like that, you know, throughout the week, and kind of, you know, yeah. But anyway.
That's a way to guarantee you don't get any love scenes, man. That's a dangerous poker play right there.
Yeah, we've been together 35 years, so there's you know, there's few lines left to cross there. But so yeah, to answer your question, it you know, it was a decision. In some ways, it made it easier to write, because I was just writing my truth. And then in other cases where I really had to imagine them in danger, and the fact that I was responsible for that to some degree. And the book, you know, you guys talked about blurred lines earlier between fact and fiction. And the book is really all about blurred lines between what you talked about, that true crime obsession that we have, you know, with serial killers and violent crimes and that kind of thing. And there really is that fine line between being, like you said, morally repulsive and sensationalistic and doing a dignified job of reporting and focusing on the victim and focusing on the survivors and that kind of thing. And I tried to kind of explore that a little bit and I put myself through the ringer. Whereas even when I was making morally responsible decisions, there's still going to be that segment of the population that doesn't see it that way. And that's okay. You know, you have to do what you know, you feel is right, but it's still a lot of blurred lines there. And some of them, like I said, you know, I don't own it, but I would wear a t-shirt with Michael Myers from Halloween on it. You know, he's make believe, you know, I would wear that to a convention or something if I ever left my house. But there are people out there who wear t-shirts with Charlie Manson on the front, and there are people who wear t-shirts with Ted Bundy. And again, you know, where's that line? You know, that's certainly a line I wouldn't even entertain crossing.
Yeah.
But
Jessica Knoll just wrote a very powerful novel based on Ted Bundy.
Mm-hmm.
I can see it, right? It's got a yellow cover. It's a very dramatic cover. And of course, I've already forgotten the name of it. I'll look it up. It just came out.
I'm with you. Yeah, no, I'm going to look it up because it sounds interesting.
Yeah, and I it is. And there's a lot of moral questions and boundary lines within the book that she resurrects with his crime spree, having gotten him to Florida, where he goes into the dormitory and starts how he got there, you know, why nobody had done anything about it, and why we all are so fascinated with creatures like that, like, you know, Hannibal Lecter or whatever it all is. What is there about, you know, the rogue? Because it is, right? It's a rogue male. What is it that's so fascinating?
For me, go ahead, Michael. You go first.
I was just going to say, I think the part of the appeal there is if you read about it or if you write about it, you're coming up and touching the nightmare, and you know you can always back away. And it is a sort of preparation for what you might have to deal with in reality. But I also think there's something much more superstitious to it, where we feel as if by watching other people's tragedies, whether they're fictional characters or if it's just a news obsession, you know, a fascination with a real crime, if we're immersed in that, we're kind of going through it in a way that makes us feel subconsciously, this is just my armchair analysis, makes us feel protected. We won't have to go through it in real life because we honored it emotionally. And I think that's part of the ritual. That's why we tell stories in general, why we read stories.
Yeah, I think that's a great answer. And when people ask me, for instance, why were you attracted to the dark side, you know, horror growing up and crime and, you know, really dark suspense. And, you know, my answer has always been, you know, similar to what you said in the beginning, where it's, you know, you're safe. You have this thrill ride. It's like getting on a roller coaster. And I hate roller coasters, and I have no desire to get on one. But you know what? You can sit me down in front of, you know, a terrifying movie for an hour and 45 minutes. I will have the blanket up. You know, I will ask to turn the lights back on. I'm still a big scaredy cat. But I know I'm going to be okay. And I know at night I'm going to put my head on my pillow. My wife's there and everything's okay. You know, the door's locked up and the security system's on. As far as the fascination with like serial killers or the rogue males, I think it's what you said about a ritual is brilliant. I think that's dead on. And I think there's also a certain like this quest for understanding, at least it is for me. You know, it's like, I want to have some, if I can find some semblance of understanding, then I can keep myself safe. And I can, you know, it's not like I'm trying to, you know, be able to spot them out in the wild, of course, or anything. My brain doesn't go in that direction, but it really is just something that is so far away from the norm and my, you know, my perspective of life that I want to understand why these people do what they do. And again, I tried to do that in Becoming the Boogeyman, where it was like, you know, the making of a monster. Are you born this way? Do you, is it nurtured in you? And I think there's a little bit of both sometimes, but yeah, I did a podcast recently where they talked about Mindhunter, and I just said so much respect for those guys who do this for a living, but I would be a mess. You know, within a month I'd be drinking and, you know, chain smoking and divorced and, you know, living in a hotel somewhere. So
I think Michael made a really good point. I remember, gosh, it was 1995. This is the only time P.D. James ever came to visit the Poison Pen. And in her talk, she said, I can still remember it, how comforting it is, she said, to lie in bed, presumably with a book, but she didn't say that, to lie in bed and know that the footstep on the stair is not really coming for you.
Absolutely.
Which I think is true. I looked up, here's the Jessica Knoll.
Oh, that's a great cover.
Yeah, Bright Young Women, and has a really, really dramatic cover. But if you're at all interested in what were serial killers and so forth, this is a very interesting book to read from a standpoint of of young women, victims that, you know, were put, but it also really tries to illuminate the fascination that somebody like Ted Bundy exerted. It's almost like a magnetism.
Right.
That instead of people smelling the fur gnome and running the way, they are sucked towards it like filings to a magnet. You know, what is it about somebody like that, that, you know, that exerts that kind of pull? I mean, Ann Rule made a fortune off Ted Bundy, as we all know, and really kind of kicked a fascination with true crime into going. But now I think, and it's really come into fiction, as I said before, I'm truly surprised at how many true crime podcasters have become sleuths.
Oh, absolutely. And that's where, you know, you get to the good and the bad of that, because you have, I think particularly in the podcasting world, you have audience trust for that voice in a way that they do not feel the trust in the police detective, because they are not hearing from the police detective. You know, that is a really interesting bond, where you learn about this tragic crime, and then there's someone every week, maybe a couple times a week, walking you through an investigation, and you have all of this frustration as a member of the community, or maybe just someone who cares. You have this frustration of, the police aren't telling me anything. You know, they're not getting the job done. And for a long time, we understood that as the nature of police work, and I think kind of made our peace with it in a different way, because there wasn't a surrogate. Now you have the podcasters are stepping forward as a surrogate in a way that, to me, is very different from a traditional journalist, because they are there offering expertise. They're not bound by the same kind of rules of attribution that a reporter would have had. And everyone can then chime in. The way their platform works, the success is dependent on people chiming in and offering their own theories. And you kind of become participants in the what you would believe is the investigation, although it has nothing to do with the investigation in many cases.
I was going to say, it's almost like you're part of this false process that, you know, that the people who are so hungry for information, you know, they're buying right into it just because, like you said, they're actually able to answer, whereas, you know, the police are not. And again, there's a scene where Kara is searching for the right word. And she says, you know, she's talking to the detective about the people who continue to email and kind of badger me in the book, and about Joshua Gallagher. And she says, you know, they're very needy, and she's not comfortable using that word, because these are people who have suffered losses, but it's the only word she could come up with, because they're desperate for answers, any kind of answers, and they can't get them from the police. And it's interesting, because I'm actually living kind of through this situation. I don't know if either of you have heard about this, but there was it was on the national news for a matter of a couple of weeks. But there was a young woman, 36, 38 year old blonde woman, who was murdered 5 minutes from my house on a nature trail. A violent crime. She actually, I haven't even said this, I've told friends this, but she actually sent me a Facebook invite like a month before she was killed. And I never, you know, responded to it, because I didn't know who she was. But yeah, she was killed on a trail, five minutes from my house. People started talking about, you know, the boogeyman, because it was such a violent crime. And I saw TikToks connecting it to the book and, you know, the whole thing, and pretty scary. And right now the community that I live in is doing what you're saying. You know, they're all about the police not providing answers, not providing information. What are they doing? And a lot of them are quoting podcasts. So it's interesting, because it's life repeating, you know.
Yeah, but if that had happened a year ago, when the idea for the sequel was gestating, do you think it would have made you step back from returning to it? Or are you able to divide the, even with this meta approach, are you able to divide the process in a way that you would have proceeded?
Oh, you know, the story was I was so attached to the story, I think I would have proceeded, but I may have made some changes in the book You know, there is, I may have not had, you know, one of the bodies discovered in the woods, and certainly not had a picture of, you know, the trampled down leaves and weeds in this wooded area, you know, that kind of thing. It's been very disturbing to have those parallels there. And I actually, you know, a bookstore who I'm doing a signing for soon was a local one, and they were distributing some flyers, and I made a point of telling them, do not put them up, you know, by the trail, because there's bulletin boards and all that. And I was just like, stay away from there. We don't need the word boogeyman anywhere near there. You know, they're going to, number one, it's not right. Number two, they're going to come to my house with like pitchforks and torches and, you know, run me out of town.
I think the positive thing here is how much empathy you're feeling, and the fact that you're connecting it on an emotional level, I would guess probably much deeper than most people would. And that shows how you treated the story with respect. I think anytime you've cared about a story, you know, I'm thinking about even just the flooding in New York a couple of weeks ago. I remember watching those videos and I'm thinking of The Chill, you know, the book that I wrote under Scott Carson name about these ghosts breaking a dam upstate and, you know, we're flooding the city. I realize I'm the only one having this thought, or, you know, maybe there are a few of us out there in the world, but most people are not. But I think it's a good thing. It's not, maybe it's wild narcissism that's possible, but I prefer to believe that it shows that I cared about the story and it was not any level of exploitation of tragedy.
Right.
So the response you're talking through with us right now, I think is probably a really healthy thing.
Yeah, no, I think so. It's you know, you can see me wrestling with those themes, you know, throughout the book. And it's you know, I'm not smart enough to make that part of it up or a good enough writer to, so I really kind of just opened up, you know, a vein there and let it out. Because, you know, I do this research, as I'm sure you do. And we've turned these killers, these serial murderers, we've turned them into celebrities in many cases. And, you know, who's partially responsible, ultimately they're responsible, but who's partially responsible for, you know, conveying that, you know, the details to the masses. And that's the people who write about it and put them on screen with television cameras and that kind of thing. So again, another blurred line of exactly how responsible we all are. You know,
even our legal system, Rich, you know, we've turned trials into spectacles. And I mean, they were originally, you know, if you want to go back to Shakespeare and Richard II and watch, you know, the huge trial by combat. But, right. You know, thinking about what you were talking about, you know, to people try to make sense out of life by storytelling, you know, with narrative and want to insert themselves into the narrative. So if you're actually talking about something like Ted Bundy, the ordinary person can't do that. But when you put a true crime podcaster on that and then invite participation, people can actually step into the story and become part of the narrative in a way that they can't, you know, they could never do if just in terms of journalism, Michael, you know, I mean, if you're writing a piece for the New York Times, you know, random people don't get to step into your piece. But
no, and I left
collaborative storytelling when you do podcasting. But
I left newspaper work right before social media intersected with it. So I never had to deal as a reporter with that back and forth of, okay, here are the comments on my story, you know, which is just one layer, let alone having a boss or a corporate overlord say, guys, this is how we monetize it. We need the back and forth. And I think that's one of the reasons, you know, I'm wandering away from talking about Rich's great book here on release night, which is not what I wanted to do, but one of the reasons I'm so fascinated by what podcasting and sort of the social media journalism has allowed. It forces the reporter into a different position. They succeed by participating with the audience in a very different way, and it needs to be constant. You know, everyone's looking for that next hit, whether it's dopamine or just information here. it's the, we're in the era of notifications as opposed to thinking and processing.
You know, you are so right. My phone, while we've been talking, has twice let me know that we have the bookstore, The Poison Pen, has just had 2 new 5-star reviews on Google. So it isn't, you know, I mean, even a business like mine is gets comments and, you know, is forced to respond. We assigned Bill, Lucky Bill, to respond so we'd have a consistent voice for doing it, you know, but it's not enough just to open the door and, you know, sell books now. You have this whole new dynamic that takes a lot of time when you're also conducting regular business. But apparently the dialogue is really important. By the way,
you just led me to a question I've been waiting to ask Rich too, which is just, I want to know what a day in the life of Rich Chizmar is, because what you managed to do with your own writing and your publishing, and then you are a force of marketing nature.
Yeah, I've been having fun.
It's like Barbara will tell me every time I come through, she'll give me a list of things I could be doing to help sell my books. And right. I feel guilty because they all seem so reasonable and they're doable. And I'm failing to do many of them. And so I try to become a little bit better. Then I look at what you're doing and I'm like, that's not reasonable or doable. What is it? How do you compartmentalize and make the time to achieve it all?
You know what? It all goes back to how I started my business right when I graduated from college. You know, I tell people, you know, in my 20s, I never took a vacation. I was so determined to make the magazine and then the publishing side of the business work that I really just, I never accepted, you know, failure as an option. And the way that I was able to make it work was there was no task that was too small. I mean, I spent years, the majority of my time was folding flyers. This, you know, this was before the internet. So the way I got the word out was direct mail. I spent so much time folding flyers instead of paying the guys at Staples to do it because I couldn't afford to. Putting stamps on, you know, mailing labels, you know, constantly searching, seeing which booksellers I could, you know, buy their mailing list from, that kind of thing, because there was only a handful of magazines that were worth, you know, taking out display ads in. So, and any small little task that I could do, and I came from it sounds silly, but I came from an athletic background. I went to college on a lacrosse scholarship. So the way I excelled at that game was always trying to outwork the guy next to me. And really focusing on the small things. So that's just always kind of my work ethic, which, you know, I think I developed through sports and watching my father, has just never left. And sometimes I drive myself crazy because I'm thinking I probably shouldn't be doing this. You know, I got the ottoman out, I got a movie on, and I'm, you know, doing these things, but it just feels like, you know, my son and I have this discussion. He's, you know, he's in his early 20s now. And I just say, you know what, maybe I shouldn't be doing this. Maybe I could be, you know, a better, you know, use of my time would be, you know, creating more, but it's just how I'm wired. So
yeah, you're talking about neuroscience at this point. Yeah. It's not silly. It's the way.
But I also enjoy it. I've made the analogy once about how I'm still that kid selling cups of lemonade on the corner. You know, I was the entrepreneur as a kid. You know, I had carnivals in my side yard and I had prizes and I would tell the kids, you know, hey, don't come back with change. Ask your parents for the green stuff. You know, and I was a major, you know, lemonade seller. And instead of just shoveling driveways for snow, you know, I would hire my friends so we could cover more ground and make more money and that kind of thing. So you think I would have been successful financially a lot sooner than I was, because first 15 years of publishing, you know, it all just went back in the business and I would like figure out my hourly rate at tax, you know, come tax time. I'm making 16 cents an hour. But anyway, yeah, I'm still selling cups of lemonade. That's how I feel.
Is there any sense of when you began to really break through in these last few years, was there any sense of not guilt, but, oh, I better not let off the gas because the minute I say I've made it, it could all fall apart?
Yeah, see, that's me. I'm never gonna say I made it. You know, it's just I live a life of gratitude. You know, I'm a 2-time cancer survivor when I was 29 and 30, and and just a lot of things in my life. So I know some people say it and then you look at them and you're like, no, you don't, you know, you're not, you're a complainer. You know, I really do live a life of gratitude. I feel very fortunate. And the difference is once I started, I feel like, okay, I'm not publishing these myself. I'm not publishing with a small house. I do feel very responsible to Simon & Schuster and Gallery Books. I feel like they put a lot of trust in me. And you know, Ed Schlesinger as my editor has done the same. So I feel like, you know what, I better bust my behind to reward that trust. And but it really does come down to I'm just that kid on the corner. And there's a sense of fun to it. There's a sense of you know, good exhaustion when it sets in. Like right now, I was going to comment before. I'm like, how do you and Barbara keep getting younger? And I'm looking at me and I've got these circles under my eyes and I'm like, but it's pub day. You know, I've been signing books all day, so I have an excuse, I guess.
But you two have both reminded me, speaking of entrepreneurship, that I completely blew it because I meant to start out and congratulate Rich and Regal Little Toast. This is publication day.
Hey.
Becoming the boogeyman.
Thank you.
I forgot to say that. I can also tell you, Michael, that those of us who got into business or got into careers pre-internet have a whole different idea of how it works. Then, you know, this is where your youth comes into play, because I can still remember me and three best-selling authors sitting on the floor of my office in my house, folding and scotch taping.
Yes.
To send it out there. We had an order for a minute and people sent checks.
Yeah, that makes me happy.
People often ask me, you know, how in the world did you ever develop, you know, this enormous international, you know, business and all? And the thing is, it's built on the basics of what we did before the internet came along. You know, it just got easier every time. You know, PayPal made it easier. You know, we went from faxing to email. That made it easier. It's now just as easy to sell a book to somebody in Jakarta as somebody in Indianapolis. But that was not true when I started back in.
Might be easier, depending on. Oh, no, I won't make a joke about my home state.
All right. So, Rich, I want to go back and ask you, there's a really interesting discussion about how you were not going to write a sequel to Chasing the Boogeyman. And you illustrate, you know, what happened. And I will say, as a kind of a spoiler here, that you've left open the opportunity for more books about the boogeyman with this book if you want to. But what was the inspiration for deciding to write a sequel that you didn't ever intend to write?
I was mowing. I this would be a good story to make up if it wasn't true, but it is. I was mowing the lawn and I had my headphones on. I was listening to music. I was not thinking about writing, which I often do when I mow. You know, we have a nice little chunk of land, so it takes a while and it's very relaxing. But for whatever reason, within just a flash, the entire first chapter of Becoming the Boogeyman came to me, and it came fully formed, and it's a long first chapter. I don't know how many manuscript pages it is, but it might be, you know, 40 pages. But I got off my lawnmower and I just had it right there. And it, the first chapter of Becoming the Boogeyman ends with a big reveal, hopefully a shocking reveal that directly ties the story back to Chasing the Boogeyman. And I was so excited because I remember what I thought was, as a reader, if I read that first chapter, I'm going to keep going and flipping those pages as fast as I can to see what happens next, because I felt like the reveal was so good. And that doesn't usually happen. So yeah, it within 5 minutes, I went from it not being even a thought in my brain to, okay, this is what I'm going to write next. And I really want to start now. So I'm gonna go take a shower and get to work pretty much. But that's how it happened.
So this is not a book where I could say you don't have to have read the first book to really enjoy the second one. This is a book that I think it really would be better if you wrote this, if you were to read Chasing the Boogeyman first. Michael, do you agree with that?
I don't know. It's more of a difficult question than I would expect, because I read them in order, but I've always liked, as a reader, coming into a mythology where I know there's something back there. And if whatever number it is, if I'm hooked, I'm going to finish that book, because that's my response to being hooked as a reader. And there's something just so wonderful about knowing oh, I can go backwards and there's more material. I mean, I remember, you know, I didn't discover Harry Bosch with the Black Echo, but I understood a little bit about who he was and what he had come through. And there are these Easter eggs that are put out through there. Stephen King, The Dark Tower, I didn't start with book one. So I guess I'm not that way as a reader.
Interesting. Well, more different, you know, how we experience.
Although I encourage everyone to buy both of his books. So. Yeah,
well, my wife refuses to read something out of order. I mean, if for whatever reason, you know, the new John Sanford just came out, if for whatever reason she hadn't had a chance to read the last one, she, no matter what she's heard about the new one, she'll refuse to read that. And if she discovers a new author, boom, she's got to go, but she's got to start right at the beginning. And, you know, I tease her about it, but that it's just the way, again, it's the way her brain is wired that she can't enjoy it if that's not the case. And, you know, they asked me to, you know, to the introduction was very important, you know, editorially for Becoming the Boogeyman, where they wanted it to make sure that it could be read as a standalone, you know, all the pieces of that puzzle are there. But yeah, I like the idea of someone reading Chasing the Boogeyman, and I feel like they can crawl into my skin much more effectively by knowing what I was like as a kid and then as a college graduate and now as a married, you know, father of two. I think they can, you know, kind of understand my thought processes and my actions, you know, much better. But yeah, I like the idea of them buying both myself.
That's interesting. I suppose because as I talk to all of you over time, I've been reading you in real time. I've read Michael in real time from the beginning. So I've never had to go back and, you know, and review it because there I am every year. John Sanford was pointing out to me that he and I have probably done 45 events together, the entire arc of, you know, the Prey novels and his other books and so forth, which I guess is why he just comes to see me anymore because it's less work for him. But, you know, I probably have that kind of mind. But additionally, I think it's just my, you know, my experience doing this. I wanted to mention something else too, which I find is coming along, which is, you know, you have all these wonderful photographs, which are really bring reality to the book and which I think are a lot of fun when you discuss them at the end. But one of my favorite books, can't remember if it was last year or the year before, was Jason Recollect's Hidden Pictures.
I love that.
Drawings that, you know, that he makes are part of the narrative. It's a whole voice, you know, from one of the characters. And so I'm wondering, when I was a kid, the Oz books were just, you know, that was my thing. And the illustrations in part were one of the reasons that I loved it. And if you read some of the classics, Howard Pyle's amazing, you know, medieval illustrations for, you know, Ivanhoe and Robin Hood and all the rest of it, or Flash Gordon and the Emperor Ming in the little, you know, the little hardcovers. I mean, you know, so the illustrations were such a big part of those, you know, fictions. And then it kind of all went away and all we had was text.
I don't understand why it went away. I think it enhances the experience and it really does deepen the memory to me. I mean, you're going through those and I'm in my mind, I'm nodding with you, but I'm also thinking of, you know, so many others where I remember my vision of the character being generated by that sketch. And it deepens it. And something that Rich has brought in as a publisher are illustrated limited editions of some of my all-time favorite books. And it, again, that deepens the experience, you know, to have, I forget which year they put out the illustrated version of The Stand, but I can, like, my image of Nick in particular just crystallized with that in a way that, you know, I knew him through the story, but it's something that publishers are always trying to save money. I get that. But for the audience, it's a much better experience.
Like Steve's Fairy Tale, which came out last year. I love the fact that that was illustrated.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, in a way, it's almost like making it, I mean, the illustrations to some degree serve the same purpose as a film script, you know, where you, if you've got the illustrations, you as the author have less to do describing, you know.
It's a storyboard. Yeah.
And I think that's part of why books like that, as Michael said, will really stick with you, you know, because you do have not just the story, but you have the image embedded in it. And I'm hoping that we're going to see more. I mean, children's books, illustration is a huge part, as you know, I mean, there's a whole award tier from the American Library Association about illustrators for children's books. And more recently, I'm happy to say translators are now getting a lot of attention, whereas before, you know, nobody kind of knew or cared. Part of that is because of the big influx in English of works written in other languages. Right. The whole Scandinavian noir thing, for example, has required translators. And so they become a lot more important than, you know, than they used to be. So Rich, what else, or Michael, what would you else would you like to ask Rich about becoming the boogeyman?
I would like to know if, I love your story about mowing the lawn, not just because I've come up with, I think, the better parts of about 9 books while mowing the lawn, but also because it's your interaction with this property. And your property seems to me, it's so well rendered in your fiction. I feel like I really know it, but do you feel, is it someplace where you feel creepy sense of this place, or just total peace and isolation? Because you can render both so well, where it's the bucolic, but then there's this kind of spooky underlying quality.
Yeah, well, for me, the spooky underlying quality is always there with everything. You know, when I said I was a scaredy cat, I was being honest. you know, I still have that overactive imagination that's bigger, you know, than it should be. And my older son is the same way. My youngest son is very practical. He watches these scary movies with us and he just laughs and he's like, oh, that was entertaining, but it wasn't scary. And, you know, Billy and I sit down to watch, you know, like the first Paranormal Activity movie. And we're like, let's finish this tomorrow in the daylight, because we're both scared to death. And we're seeing things moving out of the corners of our eyes. And yeah, you know, I had to run to my office. My office is about 10 minutes away from our house. I mean, the office that I work in now is here in the house, but the publishing office, and I had to run there last night, actually, after a signing, and it was about 9 o'clock, and my son was teasing me. He's like, aren't you scared? And I'm like, yeah, as a matter of fact, I am. And Kara's like, what are you scared of? I'm like, the dark. See, there's that split second before I got to turn the alarm off and turn the light on, you know?
What am I scared about? I mean, that's
the hand.
You can begin the list. It's endless. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. No, yeah, it's you know, Stephen King has said before, he's like, I find it charming, Rich, that after all these years, you know, you're still that guy, that you're legitimately spooked. And I'm like, you know, maybe it's why I still have so much pleasure, you know, doing it after 35 years, because I'm still that kid. But yeah, no, so yeah, my property, yeah, I what I said about the spring house, you know, everyone talks about it. It's like, oh, it's 200 something years old. It's still an operating spring house and this and that. And I'm like, no, it's the witch house. And I won't go anywhere near there right now, you know. And I, you know, made that up within a week of buying the property. I'm just like, no, I think a witch lives there. And, you know, ever since, it's the witch house. And yeah, the pond is lovely at night, but there's things that make strange sounds, and you can be like enjoying a peaceful night and the fireflies, and then there's like a fox will, you know, make this, you know, feral cry, and it's just like, all right, I'm going in, lock the door. So yeah, that's still me, and that I think that kind of old fashioned fright is, you know, all throughout Chasing the Boogeyman and Becoming the Boogeyman. It doesn't.
It is. It's one of the reasons I love your work. It reminds me of, like what McCammon did with Boy's Life, where Zephyr can be this town of the best people and the funniest sequences. And it's sort of like, it's tinged with nostalgia in a beautiful way. You feel that fondness and love. And then in, you know, the blink of an eye, the shadows come down and it's a terrifying place. Right. And you're seeing the human darkness and you're seeing the monsters. And I think you conjure that really, really well. So it's one of the reasons I enjoy your work so much.
Thank you.
So yeah, there's a powerful page here, which I'll quote from briefly, going towards the end of the book, when Chismar, Richard, our character here, is in conversation with a serial, one of the killers. And the killer says to him, I could have taken you any day. Do you realize that? not just in the summer and fall of 88, any day before or since. You think you're so smart, huh? You don't think I watched over you all the years? Wow. So, you know, you have a, Chismar in the book, a very intimate relationship with characters that you're writing about. And then Chismar says, then why didn't you, you sick fuck? And Gallagher replies, I answered that question 34 years ago, the first time you sat down with me. So there's a dance. You know, I think about your press called Cemetery Dance, but there is a dance here going on. And, you know, I think that people who were not just like plucked off the street and killed, but people who had some sort of relationship with some guy like Bundy had some kind of a dance, didn't they? Without ever knowing that they were dancing with a monster.
Yeah, I mean, for I don't know how many years people would say, what's the scariest book you've ever read? And for a long time, my answer was The Stranger Beside Me. Because when I read that book, I put myself in her shoes and, you know, was just terrified and couldn't fathom that experience and everything he did. That book haunted me. You talked about when he went to Florida, the sorority house, and he used the chunks of firewood, leftover firewood that were left outside, and they found pieces of bark, embedded in the girl's skull and stuff. That I had nightmares for weeks. And yet, I've probably read that book 4 or 5 times. So, yeah, I don't know what that says, but, it's a fascination. And, that's the roller coaster ride for me right there.
Well, I'll be interested to see if you have another epiphany where you produce yet a third book with the Boogeyman, because you haven't left it out. Michael, talk to me a moment about Scott Carson, because it occurred to me in a burst of delight that you were actually probably going to come and see us this spring when Scott Carson publishes his book.
Yeah, I sure hope so. Comes out the last week of March. And I'm not blowing smoke at Rich just because it's his pub day. His work actually really inspired this book. So I wasn't as bold as he is to, put myself on the page as a character, but I had never written about my hometown. And I love my hometown, but I think we all have very complex relationships with our hometowns. And so I had a lot of fictional stand-ins, but after reading his first one, The Boogeyman, and talking with him about that process, I thought, okay, let's go ahead and try this, because I'd always wanted to. So talk about not being brave. I'm using a pseudonym. I'm Scott Carson to write about Michael Carita's hometown, but it's set in 1999 in Bloomington, Indiana. And it's sort of it follows a little bit of my experience as a high school kid who goes to work for a private detective. And from there, it gets a whole hell of a lot more exciting. Plot-wise than maybe my experience did, but it was the emotional texture of calling back those memories. And as Rich said earlier about his, his first novel in this particular saga, it's the opportunity to spend time with people again and in places again that was really special. So yeah, the book is called Lost Man's Lane. And Rich, I think, was my first victim as a reader.
It's wonderful. It's wonderful. I was going to say, did you get the cover that you wanted? I know that was the last time we really had a discussion, because that wasn't the original title either.
No, the original title was, good memory. The original title was In a Town Like Ours.
Right. Which I loved. And I love the new one, but I remember it because, being a first reader is a real responsibility. So it's like, anytime someone asks me to do that, most of the time, unfortunately, I can't because I'm swamped. I was like, yeah, I'll take a break from whatever I'm doing and read it. Cause it's like getting a sneak peek of if John Sanford, whose real name's not John Sanford, I don't believe, but if someone like that asked me, there's only a handful of people. It's like, you drop everything. So I always tell myself, you know what, I'm going to be honest. So it was easy with you. I could say the book was wonderful. It blew me away. I wish I had written it. I remember all those things I said. And then you're like, but what title do you like better? And I'm like, because I'm leaning towards this one. I'm like, no, I like the other one better. I really liked it In a Town Like Ours. It's just, it had that Bradbury-esque Stephen King feel. But I love the new title. And to let you answer about the cover art, did you get that? that art?
Yes, I think you'll love the cover too.
Awesome.
Well, this is exciting. We already, it's only October, but you know, now we're talking about the end of March. So all good things. I don't know when, excuse me, publishing turned into the fashion industry, but I'm here to tell you that I've been asked to fill out event requests for next summer. And I have dates on the book already for the end of April into May and one for next September. I don't know what happened. You know, I just, it used to be that a box of books would arrive at the store and we'd open it with glad cries and great excitement because we didn't know what the new releases were going to be. And there is just no way that anything operates like that anymore. It's hard to generate that kind of wild enthusiasm that you had with the surprise.
I was going to say, do you miss those days? Because I
really do, because sometimes by the time I actually get the book, you know, I'm fed up with it. I just, you know, heard too much about it, the whole bit. And I try not to let other people's reviews and opinions influence me, but it's awfully hard sometimes with the barrage of PR that I get to finally get to an arc and not have some, you know, association stuff already in my head. So I'm not really sure why this is all accelerated to the degree that it has, but I can tell you it's really hard to make decisions. I mean, you know, if I see Michael's name on an event grid for next spring, it's easy for me to say, sure, we'd really love to see him. If I see a completely unknown name and I'm months away from being able to look at the book, how can I make an intelligent decision? Exactly. You know, I write that in oftentimes, you know, I will write in, send me a copy, you know, and then I'll be happy to make a talk. But, you know, right now.
It's impossible.
It is impossible. I read today in a release from Edelweiss that this very week, 1,937 new books are publishing.
Wow.
1,937, you know, well, I mean, forget it. Well, fortunately, we have this one good book. Patrick, come and see if we have any comments from the audience or whatever you might like to ask, because you love this kind of book.
I do, yeah. Actually, Stefania, our friend, who hasn't been with us for a little while, she's back.
She has a couple of good questions. She's up in the middle of the night.
That's right. And this is a question that I ask sometimes too, which is, do you think that some places or houses, can be imbued or can attract the evil in some way, especially if a place was the scene of a tragic event?
I do, but I'm the believer, like I said in the beginning, you know, so if she asked, you know, do you believe in extraterrestrials and ghosts and supernatural and all that, I'd be like, yes, yes, yes. So I absolutely do. I like to hear what Michael and Barbara would think.
Yeah, I do. I have a very kind of odd connection to that. My father was a big fan of this sort of obscure historical figure named George Rogers Clark, brother of William Clark. And when we were kids, he would take us down to this guy's house in Kentucky, and it's like a 200-year-old house. And every time we went in the place to go on the tour, which is all he wanted was to go on this, you know, dry, boring historical tour. And my sister kept fainting in different rooms of the house. And it wasn't like she was a fainter either. And I was really young the first time, like 7 or 8 years old. And I remember just like at that moment, connecting it to the house and the history of the house, because they're in the middle of talking about, you know, all of the things that have happened here. And then it's like, boom, down goes Jennifer. So I can thank my older sister for convincing me at a very young age that, you know, a house could be a charged place. And how much of that is, you know, wired into what we know about it or what we just perceive and feel is a very different question. But as Barbara knows, I'm a big fan of the Hotel Valley Ho right next door to, you know, your lovely bookstore. And there is an energy to it, to that kind of thing that comes from the history and from the architecture. But I also feel like you just, as a storyteller, you get a little charged. You know, you have a sense that something more is there. So that was a very long-winded answer. Sorry.
No, it's a great answer, because I'm waiting for you to actually write your book set at the Hotel Valley, which is going to be amazing. So, Patrick, anyway, Stefania, it's very nice to have you. And I'm amazed that you can stay up so late to join us, but thank you for doing. Right.
Let's see. Yeah. Well, somebody was just weighing in, Robin, she says, I need to start a series from the beginning. Yeah, getting back to that. Okay, so here's the question. All right, do you think that a writer has to keep a moral code in their books? Is it better to not write about some specific themes, or is everything allowed?
Oh, I mean, I think everything is allowed. I just think it's such an individual choice. You know, you have to sit down and you have to, for me, I have to write honestly. So, you know, if I'm writing about a topic that, you know, crosses lines, it's just interesting because I feel like I would have to be as authentic and as honest as I could. But the thing with me is I just, you know, the Boogeyman books are campfire stories. I'm very much a traditionalist, old kind of old fashioned storyteller. So the way my brain works, you know, I can't imagine spending, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 months on something that I found, you know, morally repulsive. And maybe I'm missing out on telling, you know, a really powerful story because of that. But, you know, I just, you know, it is just not the way that I operate.
I agree. And I think to me, it's about intent. You know, when you come to the page, what your intention is. The audience might not love the way you handled it, but if you feel that you were doing the right thing, and there was a reason to go into these sort of darker areas beyond a cheap thrill, then I think you're fine. I've always wanted to try to avoid anything, you know, never treat a victim, and maybe this is like the PI and journalist background, but don't treat a victim as just, I need a plot device. So this, you know, body on the ground is to get me from chapter 9 to 10. Think about it more as, okay, this person has a family, even though they're not a real person. Because I think that's served me well. And it's the writers who I really admire in our genre. You know, I think of Connolly, Lehane, you know, Laura Lippman. It's a lot of people who have more respect for victims than just as a plot device.
You know, I'm not sure it's entirely respect to victims. I still believe somebody who said that the best books are the ones where you mourn the victim and possibly even empathize with the villain, but more in the victim. I think if you don't have that emotional attachment, you know, to and a sense that something valuable was lost, if it's just, you know, a casual death, it doesn't get your heart.
No, the reader feels that. You know, if the writer doesn't care, why would the reader? And that's exactly when we put a book down. We know so quickly on a subconscious level that the writer didn't care. And then we check out. So it's your responsibility, but it's also just good business.
Yeah. Sometimes when you sense that the author is working its way, his or her way towards killing a particular character, every once in a while, I have to put that book down because I just don't want to read that.
I'm with you.
I remember what the book was, but that actually happened to me yesterday. And I could just see that this person was the one that, you know, was, and I thought, you know, no, I just couldn't bring myself to read about it. Mm-hmm. So there you go. Right. Anyway, Patrick, carry on.
Chris has a nice comment, which is, as I've gotten older and have raised a child to an adult, I get more emotional with events and what I read and what I watch on TV. I suppose I feel the events and how they affect the characters more intensely. Does anyone else feel that way?
Mm-hmm. I think with good writing, yeah. I mean, and that's one of my attractions to true crime is that, you know, I feel like you have, they, you know, the true crime format, you're allowed to spread out a little bit more and you learn more about the victims, you learn more about the survivors than you do in fictionalized, you know, in fictionalized stories. You know, there's entire chapters sometimes devoted to a single, you know, victim. So you really get to know about this person, you know, their hobbies, things that you don't have the room, you know, to cover in a novel often, you know, because of the old narrative drive. You got to keep the story, you know, powering forward. And I know the same thing is true with true crime, but it just feels different. And again, the pictures, you know, the reason I put those pictures in there is because the experience that I've had with true crime books and those photographs, I find myself stuck on them, and they're never gory or grisly photos. They're just simple. You know, it's the bedroom of the girl who was murdered. And I'm just imagining her at her desk. I'm looking at the posters. I'm looking, what are those knickknacks she has on her shelf? And sometimes the murder sites are nothing. I can never remember which book it was, but it was a picture of a patch of grass that was trampled down behind a shed in a suburban neighborhood. And that photograph haunted me for weeks. Because it was where she took her last breaths, and I thought about it, and so for me, the more you get to know that character, certainly the more you care, and the more that they stay with you.
Agreed, 100%.
You know what? I just noticed, is that a ping pong table you've got back there, Michael?
No.
Oh, is that a ping pong table?
I like how I checked, though.
It looks like there's a racket there. So I'm sorry, I'm not looking at it correctly.
Oh yeah. No, I can see what you're looking at, right in front of my penguin with his mask.
Yeah.
No, that's just a desk.
Just a desk. Okay. Let's see here.
I'd love to have a ping pong table. That would be the best way to procrastinate when I should be writing. It's got that healthy Jack Torrance of the Overlook kind of vibe.
Exactly.
Throwing the ball.
Here's maybe a good last question. Is there a scary scene in any particular book that you've read that, you know, has stayed with you? I'm sure there are quite a few, but anything come immediately to mind?
You can answer that one first, Michael.
There are so many. I think it's top of mind because I just referenced it, but The Shining, everything about that hotel and the progressive isolation and the snow coming down and communication going out, but particularly, that elevator that comes up by itself, and it's got all of the sort of debris from the party from the past, that one will always stay with me.
Yeah, for me, it's in Steve's It when I think it's Bill Denbrough who stays after class to wipe the chalkboards for the teacher, and then he walks home next to the canal, and it's winter, and he sees
Ben, isn't it?
Yeah, it is Ben, and he sees Pennywise on the ice, and the balloons are blowing in the opposite direction of the wind, and. Yeah, no matter how many times I'm always waiting for someone to ask me to write an essay on the scariest scene that I can remember, and I always want to cover that beat by beat, because I can feel and hear the wind, my cheeks hurt, I can feel the biting cold, and just that moment where he realizes that the balloons are blowing in the opposite direction, that's the scariest.
Be amazing to be inside Stephen King's head, wouldn't it? Just absolutely amazing. How lucky we all were that the car that hit him didn't kill him. And he's.
Can you think, Barbara, of a scary scene?
No, not particularly. I like Gothic. I really love Gothic stories, and I'd have to really, not Rebecca, but Rebecca de Maurier wrote another book, that name of which I can't remember, that I think has a particularly scary scene. I think Poe has some really scary stuff, you know,
Poe has some terrifying scenes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Madness is terrifying.
It absolutely is.
One of my favorites, I'll submit one real quickly, is in The Silence of the Lambs, the film version I'm thinking of. And it's a scene, you remember, where they're transporting Hannibal Lecter? And the thing is that they have to roll him on trolley. And it's like, you know, he's just too dangerous to even let him walk. You know, he's in this thing and the metal. I think just that scene I found to be so terrifying.
It's interesting that the visual sometimes has the biggest impact. I mean, you can
read it. It's not an action scene, it's just a...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's been a wonderful conversation. I will say that one of the things that Rich, the character in this book, mentions is how his life has been trashed by the success of Chasing the Boogeyman. And oh dear, he's been forced to go on book tour and appear at book fairs, which he hadn't, and many Zoom events and so forth. So I'd like to say, Rich, that I'm so happy you overcame your general dismay for and joined us this evening, because if I'd read that first, I might have said, I'll let you off the hook, and yeah, Michael and I'll just talk about the book.
No, I know. My agent's still, she's still the same thing. She's like, do you have to really make me seem like I'm such a money grubber? Because she's so wonderful and she's nothing like that. But I'm like, well, I'm just playing around a little bit with the stereotype there. And I tried to make it, authentic, that I'm kind of this homebody who is, you know, I'm a social misfit, you know, so I'm comfortable behind a computer screen a little bit, but, and I, you know what, I'm really not. I had a wonderful time at this signing last night. I spoke for, you know, I answered questions for 45 minutes and we all laughed and had a great time. So I just need to get out of my shell a little bit.
Well, thank you very much for doing so for an hour this evening. I would like to thank Michael Carita, our 5-star frequent reviewer and host. It's always a pleasure, Michael, to spend time with you. I will look forward, we might see each other before then on screen, but I will certainly make every effort to get you here in March, because I'd be excited to see you and Scott Carson. So thank you all very much for joining us. Again, we do have autographed copies, not a lot left of Becoming the Boogeyman. And we do actually have the paperback of Chasing the Boogeyman, should you want to read it first. So enjoy the rest of your evening, everybody. Good night. Thank you. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.